1854, a 2-cent copper coin was minted, bearing for the first time the words, "In God We Trust." That continued somewhat with minted coins until the early 1900s. Teddy Roosevelt felt that having God intermingled with money was a conflict. Well, the scripture teaches us that we cannot serve God and mammon, so he had it removed. But later in 1956, Congress changed the motto of the United States from E Pluribus Unum, out of many comes one, to In God We Trust. And at that point, it was to be placed on all paper currency. We see it now on currency, paper, coins alike, and it has become common in our minds as we think about it. But is it true, is the question. The answer is fairly obvious and self-evident. The reality does not support the image that is seen there. The reality is that we would come far more close to trusting the money upon which In God We Trust is printed than the God represented is the object of that motto. Now, is this a condemnation? It is a condemnation, but it's also an observation. It's an observation of a reality that exists in every age, in every culture, in every group of people. The greatest struggle that we have is trusting what we say we believe. And we may be able to do it on one day fairly well, but on the next not so much. And that struggle is a daily activity in which we find ourselves either surrendered to God and able to trust in Him or not, and thereby trusting something else, ourselves, our money, for example, or whatever. In God We Trust is nothing more than a reminder to us of something that is an ideal, but often an unrealized ideal. A conflict, putting it on money, knowing that we are far more likely to be drawn to the money than we are to God who is represented on it. So how do we turn this around, or how do we see through this? I don't know that we can do a great deal about anybody else until we have worked and allowed God to work in our own hearts individually and personally. So it's probably not important for us to consider this from a national point of view. It's probably not important for us to consider it from a cultural perspective. And I wouldn't suggest that it's even something that we can do church-wide. I believe it is a matter of each individual heart. So that I would encourage all of us to look deep within today, to see what we are trusting in, the one in whom we have placed our trust. We know what we believe, but do we trust Him? Do we take that step of faith? Do we follow Him? Do we model and shape our lives so that they are a reflection of Him? These are questions that bring us back to reality. In the midst of all of that, setting the tone, there's a similar set of circumstances that arises in the passage that we're dealing with today in Luke chapter 21. And you wouldn't think so when you read it. You would think that this is about the second coming. This is an end times passage, an end times message only, and that we need to focus on that. And yet there is so much more here. So what I want to do is I want you to look at this passage, because it's going to deal with whether or not we are trusting in God. And Jesus is addressing that and calling that out in all of us, but he's doing so in the context of a much larger worldview and a much more eternal perspective, so that we'll see that as it all comes to bear. As we think about In God We Trust and we consider the reality of what that represents for all of us, a similar set of circumstances unfolded in the days of Jesus as he is in Jerusalem and he is there at the temple. In verse 5 of chapter 21, he says, while some were speaking of the temple, how it was adorned with noble stones and offerings, he said, as for these things that you see, the days will come when there will not be one stone left on another. So let's get the picture of what's going on here. It's very similar to situations and circumstances that we might find ourselves in today. The people are gathered around the temple. They are standing there and they're observing. And they start to comment on its beauty. Uses the term noble stones. And it's talking about the stones that comprise the foundation and the walls of Herod's temple. Now you realize that the temple started as a tabernacle in the wilderness. So Moses, as he led the people across the wilderness and as he led them into the land of promise, did so by guiding them in worship and connection with God through a tent of meeting. It was not a permanent structure because they didn't have a permanent location yet. And so they go across the wilderness. They come into the land. They occupy the land. They still continue to meet in the tabernacle. They still continue to meet in a tent. It is not until David subdues all the enemies and desires to build a temple to the Lord. And God says to him, no, you're a man of war. Your son will do that. Solomon constructs the first permanent temple. And it is glorious and beautiful. You can read about it in the Old Testament and you will see there how God came in and that the presence of the Lord filled the temple upon its blessing like smoke. And the people shouted and they praised and they sang and they celebrated and they worshiped and they gave of their lives. And it was a great day and a great time. That temple is destroyed. And it is completely demolished by the Babylonians. The people that are carried off into captivity remain so for 70 years. Eventually they come back. We read about the reconstruction of the temple in the city of Jerusalem in Nehemiah, in Ezra. We read other parts of the Old Testament and prophetic writings that have something to do with that. Haggai speaks to the temple in particular. We've been studying about this in Sunday school in our small groups, in many of the groups at least that are using Gospel Project material. And so we have a little bit of an understanding of that. This bore no resemblance, hardly, to the original temple of Solomon. It was smaller. It was nowhere nearly as elaborate in its adornment. And it stayed that way. For years and years and years, it stayed that way. Herod comes to power in the period of the Roman occupation in Palestine, and Herod the Great, wanting to endear himself to the people, wanting to connect with the Jews. He was part Jew himself. He starts to build onto the temple. He starts to make modifications. He starts to expand it. And it becomes far larger than Solomon's temple, and it becomes far more ornate, so that some historians have said that Herod's temple could easily have been considered among the seven wonders of the world. It was that amazing. Now, Herod was an evil, wicked psychopath. But they loved him because he built a beautiful temple. Or at least they tolerated him. Herod ordered the killing of children to try to eliminate Jesus as a baby. But he had a beautiful temple. The people are standing there in the presence of Jesus and the disciples as they are going about this week of passion leading up to what will be the crucifixion of Jesus and ultimately his victory over death. And they are standing there and they are commenting on how beautiful this temple is. And Jesus responds and says, the day is coming when not one single stone that you see standing here will be left on top of another. You see, they started off with flawed thinking. They had flawed thinking. In verses 5 through 9, we see some of that flawed thinking and the way that it is represented. But really, verse 5 kind of consolidates it for us and condenses it into a very small window. And when he says that they were speaking of the temple and how it was adorned, and he said these things will come, and the day will come when they will no longer exist, essentially, is what he's telling us. Then he is saying to them, you're trusting the wrong thing. You're trusting in the temple. You're trusting in its strength and size. You're trusting in its elaborate adornment and its wealth. But you're not trusting the God that it was built to worship in. You're not trusting God, who is the one to whom this building rose up in the first place. The reality is that the presence of God has not been in the temple during all of the time of Herod, even before that. The presence of the Lord left the temple before it was destroyed in the Babylonian conquest and has never returned. And what is about to ensue is going to be, after its reconstruction, 400 years of absolute silence. Malachi will bring all of that to a close, and we will not hear another word of prophecy from the Lord's mouth until John the Baptist appears on the scene. And none of it happens in the temple. The most noteworthy thing that takes place in the temple is Jesus trying to drive the money changers and to drive out the thieves from the temple and return it to a house of prayer. The most notable thing that will be remembered for during this period of time in the temple will be when he dies, the veil will be torn and the way will be opened. But all of the things that they were praising it for now, flawed thinking. We have the same problem. We still think that buildings and places and things of this nature are the means by which we worship. And I think it's good that we have a place, and we are grateful and blessed to have a place that is so nice and so wonderful that we can gather together in a large group like this. Think about what it would take if we were to have a space large enough in order to have one service and to get everybody in. It would have to be almost twice this size. And so we can use this for multiple services, and we can use it in multiple ways in order to reach so many people. And that's great. But it's still just sticks and bricks. It's still just a place that will not endure. It is still just something that is going to go through transformation and renovation and change and update and alteration. Even in the time that we have done so much work in this building, and we took down the old original building, we built a brand new one in its place, we renovated all of the education space over there in the early 90s, we now use that space in ways and have renovated almost every inch of it again in order to accommodate transformation and change that has taken place in the way we do ministry. That's going to be a continuing reality for us, and it's going to be an ongoing process in which we are always going to be reminded that this is but a tool, but it is not the end. The end is always our focused attention on God, and when we fail to see that, we have flawed thinking and we're trusting in something that cannot provide. They trusted in the temple, but they ignored God. We can trust in the appearance of religion and at the same time ignore God. When Jesus said that the temple would be destroyed in verses 5 through 9, he also went on and said in verse 10 that there would be wars and there would be persecution and there would be famine. He says in verse 11, great earthquakes, and in various places famines and pestilence and terrors and great signs from heaven. But before all this, they will lay their hands on you and persecute you before kings and governors for my name's sake. This will be your opportunity to bear witness. Settle it therefore in your minds not to meditate beforehand how you will answer, but I will give you a mouth and wisdom which none of your adversaries will be able to withstand or contradict. You will be delivered up even by parents and brothers and relatives and friends, and some of you will be put to death. You will be hated by all for my name's sake, but not a hair of your head will perish. Your endurance, you will gain your lives. But when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation has come near. Then let those who are in Judea flee into the mountains, and let those who are inside the city depart, and let not those who are out in the country enter it, for these are days of vengeance to fulfill all that is written. Alas, for women who are pregnant and for those who are nursing infants in those days, for there will be great distress upon the earth and wrath against this people, and they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led captive among all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. They began with flawed thinking, believing that the temple would stand forever and that nothing could ever unsettle or unseat its authority in their lives. But Jesus reminded them that not only did they have flawed thinking, they had a false sense of security. Jerusalem was a great and powerful city, and it was well fortified and well defended. Its walls were high and thick, and so they believed that it would be sufficient in order to protect them from all comers. And even though they were under the oppressive regime of Rome at that time, they still believed that there would come a time where they would be delivered from that, and this would be the place of refuge for them. Jesus says, no, it will not be a place of refuge. In fact, he says, there will be no place in the land, for there will be wars, and there will be rumors of wars. And all of these things are going to happen, and it's going to come quickly. It's going to be hard on those who are caring for young ones. It's going to be hard for those who are older and unable to flee. And many are going to die and fall by the sword. What was he talking about? He was talking about the destruction of Jerusalem that would take place in 70 A.D., Rome would come back, and after the Jews had mounted an opposition force, Rome would come back and lay siege to the city of Jerusalem. For 6 months, it would be besieged, eventually falling to the Roman authorities. During that time, it is estimated that somewhere between 600,000 and 1 million Jews are killed, slaughtered by the Romans. The numbers and the estimates historians have provided vary so greatly that it's hard to know with any degree of accuracy. But one thing you can know is that the bodies that littered the streets of Jerusalem and lined the surrounding countryside were so immense and numerous that people looking at them couldn't even begin to count them. The numbers of Jews that were taken into captivity and deported and sent throughout the land, and those who fled, meant that Jerusalem was no longer Jewish, and Judea was no longer inhabited by Jews. And it would remain that way until the 1940s. Now, what does this mean? Some say, well, that's not what that's talking about. That's talking about the end of time. It is certainly giving us a picture of what the end of time will be like, in the regard that you see a double meaning there. But really what it's focused on is the time of the Gentiles. That's why he says at the conclusion of this verse that I just finished reading to you, that there will be a time until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. What is that? Is it the time that the Gentiles rule over the Jews? Or is it the time in which the gospel is being preached to the Gentiles? And the answer again is yes. It's both. But the time of the Gentiles is the time that you and I are living in right now. In fact, you and I are part of that. And what he was saying is that the Jews had received the message of hope and promise and peace, but they had kept it to themselves. They had not shared it. When the Messiah came, they did not recognize him. And so as a result of all of these things, judgment now falls upon them. That judgment eliminates them from the prominent place of being God's chosen ones, so that now the Gentiles rise up. And Paul says, I will take the gospel to the Gentiles. And he does so that Jesus, who said, go preach the truth to every creature, now starts to see that fulfilled. That's still what's happening now. Does it mean the Jews don't play prominently in the plan of God? It does not. And it does not mean that God will not honor all the promises that he has made to those people. He certainly will, just as he will to us. What is the point? The point is they were trusting the wrong thing, and it was because of flawed thinking. And they were trusting in things that could not protect them, which gave them false security. What are you trusting in today? I was talking to my dad this past few days. Kathy and I went down to see him. He's been having some health issues, and so we wanted to be sure that the routine that he was in and the process that he was a part of at this point was something that he could manage and feel good about, and it was going to produce good results. I came away from the experience we did feeling that it is something that he can manage, and it seems to be working out quite well, and that it will have good results. And so for all of you who've asked about him, thank you for that. Continue to pray for him. It's going to take several weeks, perhaps months, for this to be concluded. But during that time, he was telling me about one of the doctors who has provided care to my mom and now also to my dad, who's a member of their church. And during a recent service, realized that his profession of faith had not been something that had come from his heart, but rather something he had done as a young person to just kind of go along with other people who were doing a similar thing. And as a grown man and as a prominent member of that community, but also of that church, he stepped forward and said, "I want to give my life to Jesus." In so doing, he gave a witness and a testimony that it is possible to give the appearance of religion and faith without its substance to save. The question is, what are you trusting in? Do you have a false sense of security because you're trying to be a good person, or because you have been baptized at Temple Baptist Church or some other place or some other occasion, or because you're connected to other people that you consider to be very faithful and religious and you're hoping to ride their coattails in somehow? Do you imagine that maybe you may not occupy one of the higher places or realms of heaven, but if you can just get in the door, even the slums of heaven will be better than the palaces of hell? I'm telling you that all of that speaks of and smacks of insecurity. And God has spoken to us with great clarity and said, "Beyond any measure of doubt, these things have I written that you may know you have eternal life." They were trusting the wrong things. They had flawed thinking. They were trusting the wrong things, and it gave them a false sense of security. But look at the passages in verses 25 through 33. Because Jesus now turns it around and he moves beyond the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And he now offers them hope for a future that is yet to be realized. He says in verse 25, "There will be signs in sun, moon, and stars, and on the earth, distress of nations in perplexity because of the roaring of the sea and the waves, people fainting with fear and with foreboding of what is coming on the world. For the powers of the heavens will be shaken, and then they will see the Son of Man coming in a cloud with power and great glory. When these things begin to take place, straighten up, raise your heads, for your redemption is drawing near." And he told them a parable. "Look at the fig tree and all the trees. As soon as they come out in leaf, you see for yourselves and know that the summer is near. So also when you see these things taking place, you know that the kingdom of God is near. Truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all this has taken place. Heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will never pass away." So does he speak of the end times? Well, certainly he does, and that's what this is. Jesus said that he was going to leave the disciples, and he prepared them and taught them and told them he would send them another comforter and told them that they would understand the word, told them they would receive power from above. And then it says that he ascended back into heaven, and they stood there gazing into heaven, and the angel came and stood by them and said, "Why are you looking into heaven? For you will see him coming again in the same way that he departed." Jesus says here that you will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds. This is how you know this is talking about the end. When you see Jesus coming in the clouds, it is over. Now here's the deal that gets me. When we talk about the second coming of Jesus, and that's very much a part of our doctrinal foundation and very much a part of biblical teaching, I realize that there's a lot of interpretation that goes on and there's a lot of misunderstanding about what this particular thing means or that, and I don't care to get into that with you. But let me say this. There is no dispute that Jesus is coming again. Jesus came the first time as a suffering servant, and he gave his life as a ransom for our sins. He's not coming back that way the second time. He's coming back as the judge of the living and the dead. And the Bible is very clear, eminently clear, that every knee will bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus is Lord. And that is going to be true on earth, under the earth, and in heaven. Make no mistake about it. Jesus is coming as conquering Lord and as Lord of all. The question remains, are you ready for it, number one, and are you eager for it, number two? I am ready for it. I am ready for it, not because I have done everything that is necessary. I'm ready for it because Christ has done everything that is necessary, and I trust Jesus. That's why I'm ready for it, and that's the only way any of us can be ready for it. Are we eager for it? Or, like Lot's wife, do we long for all that Sodom offers us so that even as we're being delivered from its destruction, we cannot but help turning around and with longing looking back? I fear that we cling to the things of this world because we love them more than we love God. This is a hard thing indeed. Jesus said, where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. What do you value above all else? You see, the point of what Jesus was teaching them had less to do with a hope of offering them something in the future that would give them deliverance from the travail. But you got to keep in mind that the majority of the people that were hearing Jesus speak were people who had nothing. They had no money. They owned no property. They had very little in the way of job opportunity. There was no advancement possible for them. They were going to live out their meager lives in the meager conditions that they had always known. And that was all they would ever expect to have. Most of them would not live past 35 years old. And many of them would die without any heritage of any sort. So that when Jesus offered them hope of a future that would be free of all of that, it meant something to them. But look at us. We don't need heaven. We have Amazon. We don't need deliverance. We have Walmart. Everything that we could possibly want or need at a moment's notice. Saturday or Friday night, we were at the house, and Dad had gotten back from his treatment time, and we were sitting there, and he says, you know, he said, I have this product that I buy, and he said, I used to get it when we were in Little Rock, and he said, I don't go to Little Rock anymore, and he said, it's not available here. He said, how would I go about getting that? I picked up my phone and said, what's the name of it? And he said, yes. He said, it'll be here Tuesday. He said, how you do that? I said, well, I have your credit card stored in my Amazon account. And you said you wanted it, so I billed it to your credit card. I sent it to 2927 Mount Holly Highway in Smackover, Arkansas, and they're going to bring it to you. I just don't know how you do that. I know you don't, Dad. That's why you don't do it. You just ask me to do it. And that's okay. Can you get on the Amazon for me and get me some of that, you know, stuff you did before? Yeah. It's just amazing. It's like magic. That's how easy it is. We don't even think about it. We don't argue over facts and details. Just ask Siri. She'll settle it for you. Everything is available at our touch, at our beck and call, everything in a moment's notice. And yet the danger is that we have grown satisfied with the dregs that are offered by this world. And in the process, we have ignored the hope of the glory found in the perfection of the reigning Lord and Savior coming again. Every believer should look at the very best that this world has to offer and willingly, gladly, and joyfully relinquish it to open his arms to embrace Jesus. But we don't. Future hope can only be hopeful if you're ready for it, if you want it, if you desire it. What do you desire more than Jesus? In verses 34 through 38, we see faithful obedience. Jesus, I'm sure, understood this and understands much about us. I'll do it quickly. Hang tight. He says, "Watch yourself, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the cares of this life, and that day comes upon you suddenly like a trap. For it will come upon all who dwell on the face of the whole earth. But stay awake at all times, praying that you may have strength to escape all these things that are going to take place and to stand before the Son of Man." And every day he was teaching in the temple, but at night he went out and lodged on the Mount of Olivet. And early in the morning the people came to him to hear him. He says, "Watch yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with dissipation and drunkenness and the cares of this life." Is that not exactly the warning I've been talking about? Jesus said as he started, you're looking at the temple and you're declaring it to be such a wonderful place and such a beautiful structure and you have such trust in it. He said, I'm telling you, it's about to be destroyed. He says, on the other hand, he says, you're being caught up with dissipation, with the cares of this world, with drunkenness and revelry and recreation and all the other things that it has to offer. And in the process of doing so, you are going to be unprepared when he comes. And when he comes, you will be caught as in a trap. Where's your heart today? How many times have you said no to Jesus? How many times have you refused the gospel? How many times have you turned away from the truth? How many excuses and how many things have you said that have been put off until the later time, just delaying it one after the other after the other? How long will you continue? The day is coming. You say, well, we've got lots of time. You don't have any time. Time doesn't belong to you or me. You and I belong to time. You don't believe that? Try to stay in this moment as the next one comes into existence. You can do that in your head, but after a while, you know what they do? They take you away. That's what they do. Because you've become delusional and deceived. And you have to go someplace softer. And sleep for a while. You can't stop it because you and I belong to it. And we are ruled by it. And Jesus is coming. What I'm telling you is he is not to be dreaded. He is to be longed for. He is feared. He is to be looked forward to. He is to be welcomed, not because you've used up everything in this life and not because you no longer feel the way you once did. My dad was telling me, he said, boy, he said, it's hard getting old. He said, it's just not for the weak anymore. He said, I don't even know how much longer I want to hang around here. And I think to myself, that's how we often are. Once we get to the point where we can't do what we want and be in charge of everything that we once were, now we're ready to go see Jesus. But up until then, I got this, God. That's not the way it works. Jesus was shifting the gaze and focus of an entire world, of all of history, away from everything they had known to something they had never seen before or understood. And today, that is exactly what he has called us to be. So that when we stand together, we can declare with confidence, in God we trust.